The MMQB podcast is brought to you by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your tickets, and get your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code MMQB for $20 off your first tickets. We're also sponsored by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football, with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter the promo code THEMMQB at FanDuel.com for a bonus match of up to $200.
If I had come out of that experience and said, wow, they've got a lot of idiots talking to these NFL players and giving bad advice, then I think it would be my responsibility to relay some of that bad advice. But I just didn't feel that way coming out of the symposium.
We're literally debating one's interpretation of fate or spirituality or what. I mean, this is the debate of all mankind. It's Andy Benoit here with Robert Klemko of the MMQB podcast. And we've got a lot of injuries to talk about this week, Robert. We have quarterback competitions getting settled. And we have a little interesting controversy, mini controversy, that involved you, my good friend.
Less interesting and more annoying.
Well, that's how it goes when you're on the other end of those things, or so I have learned. We're going to get to that, the Chris Carter thing, at the towards the end of the show. We also have Emily Kaplan later in the show. You want to start talking with these injuries, though? Those are the most football-relevant topics.
Yeah, let's cycle through these. We've got a lot of show for you guys today. Very excited that you're joining us. The first one that I wanted to bring to your attention, and I'm sure you already know about it, but Jordy Nelson tears his anterior cruciate ligament Sunday morning in a preseason game. And, you know, we could have an hour-long discussion about whether or not these games are worth anything or worth the risk, really. But I wanted to get your take on what this means for the Packers offense. Now, mind you, this isn't as big of a loss as the Panthers losing a Kelvin Benjamin, because the Packers do have Randall Cobb, whom they signed for 4 years, $40 million in March, a guy that had 91 catches last year and figures to at least reach that point this season. So what are your thoughts on how losing Jordy Nelson affects the Packers offense?
Well, so I'm not allowed to say it's bigger than Kelvin Benjamin, though. Mind me, right? This is a leading question, Klemko.
Well, you can say whatever you want.
No, I agree with you. I think the Benjamin injury is bigger because of the team it happened to and the style of passing game, and we went over that last week about Carolina and how Benjamin fits their system. Obviously, Jordy Nelson fits Green Bay's system. The productivity speaks for that alone. He's excellent on quick slants, excellent on back shoulder catches, and those are the two biggest facets of the Packers' passing attack. Having said that, I don't think this impacts Green Bay a whole lot. I think Nelson's an excellent player. I think he's every bit as good as his stats and his contract suggest. But when you have Aaron Rodgers at quarterback and that style of offense that they run, I think the passing yards will now just get redistributed, and Davante Adams will have a bigger year. Randall Cobb might wind up matching his productivity from a year ago. And Ty Montgomery, their third-round rookie, he obviously they're counting more on him. But let's say even if he doesn't step up, you know, then maybe a Jimmy Hunt or somebody, an undrafted rookie for them. Someone else will rise up for Green Bay, because when you have arguably the league's best quarterback, your wide receivers are in a very favorable position.
Mm-hmm. I think that you're right in that it won't be noticeably affected. Jordy Nelson did account for 34% of their passing offense, but when you have an Aaron Rodgers or a Peyton Manning or a Tom Brady or a Drew Brees, you know you're going to succeed pretty much no matter who's playing wide receiver. I think the problem with losing a Jordy Nelson, a guy that's been on the roster in Green Bay since 2008, is that now there's one less guy that Aaron Rodgers can look at on third and long and just that look across the line of scrimmage and say, all right, are you seeing what I'm seeing? This is something that we faced 100 times. I know exactly what you're going to do. I know exactly when you're going to throw it. I think in these tight games, it can mean the difference between converting a couple third longs and not. And I think it makes the offense a little bit less flexible, though I don't think it'll show up in the stats.
Yeah, and that's a great way to say that too, because what you're basically saying is it's not going to show up in the stats, but it might still matter in the games. And I agree with that. I think look, Jordy Nelson's a top 15 wide receiver. If you lose him at some point, that's going to negatively impact your offense, no matter who else you have around him. It's a question of to what degree. And for me, Green Bay is still the favorite, and we're going to do our prediction show next week, but Green Bay is still my favorite in the NFC North. This injury does give me pause about predicting how far they'll go once the playoffs arrive, though.
Mm-hmm. The second big injury out of the four that we're going to discuss here, Marquise Pouncey, the Steelers center, placed on short-term IR with a broken bone in his fibula. And let me just say, if I broke a bone in my fibula, I would probably be on long-term IR. But this is a big deal for the Steelers. Really great interior lineman. I think he's a little bit overrated among football types. I'd like to get your thoughts.
How do you mean?
Well, I think a lot of people put him in the top five centers in the league, and I just don't see him that way. I think he struggles in some of these division games, especially against Baltimore. I mean, that's when I've really noticed that he's kind of a non-factor in games late in the season against Baltimore.
Yeah, and I'd have to look closer at that, my film notes on that, or go through it to recognize that specifically. I think Pouncey's as good as any center in the game, potentially. Now, maybe he's not quite as consistent as, say, a Nick Mangold was 2 or 3 years ago, but if you lose Marquise Pouncey, you're losing one of your most mobile offensive linemen, obviously your centerpiece, your fulcrum, which is a big deal in Pittsburgh's scheme, and you're losing one of your more intelligent offensive linemen, and that also matters at the center position. Now, having said that, Pittsburgh has been, this group has been together for several years. Cody Wallace, not a great talent, but has had playing time. Mike Munchak, it looks like that's going well with him as the offensive line coach. I think they can certainly weather this storm, and especially when you consider that Le'Veon Bell, so much of what he does is outside on running plays. He's not an inside runner, even though he's built like that. I think it's like 80% of his rushing yards get to the perimeter eventually. So, but you could also argue that Pouncey's a big part of that in the zone game with his mobility. So I think the loss hurts, but I get the sense you're saying you don't think it's as big a deal.
Well, I'm not going to say that it's not a big deal. I think it definitely damages their run game, though you do mention that this isn't exactly, Le'Veon Bell's bread and butter going up the middle. I think they do get a pretty good replacement in Doug Ligurski if he can stay healthy. If you'll remember last year, he was among the parade of guys to play center in San Diego. Previous to that, spent, I believe, 5 seasons in Pittsburgh. So you get a guy that's familiar with the coaching staff in Ligurski. You couldn't say that for guys who have been away from teams for 3 seasons in most places, but in Pittsburgh, you can say that.
Yeah, you can say that, and it'll be interesting to see how effective Pouncey is if he comes back, because with an ankle injury, you're very limited in your training. You can't run. His conditioning is going to be shot, and his game's predicated largely on mobility. So I'm skeptical, even if he comes back mid-season, it's going to take him a while to adjust. Pittsburgh's going to have to win significant games without their all-pro center this year in order to make the playoffs.
Mm-hmm. So the third big injury that we've had, and these things just keep pouring in. I mean, it really sucks as an NFL fan. But cornerback for the Dallas Cowboys, Orlando Scandrick, collides with Lucky Whitehead, confirmed torn ACL. In your mind, how much does this hinder the Dallas defense, keeping in mind that they did draft a cornerback in Byron Jones in the first round this year?
Yeah, they did, but from what I've heard, Byron Jones has come along slowly because he's had a shoulder injury, much like Morris Claiborne had a shoulder injury that hindered his development a year or two ago. So this loss, I think this is the biggest of the injuries thus far. Maybe not quite Kelvin Benjamin, but I think we ought to have led with Scandrick because I think that's the biggest of the group we're talking about.
In your mind, who ends up starting at left and right cornerback, and who ends up playing the slot there?
Well, that second part of that question is the key, is who plays the slot. And I talked to Peter today, and he told me that They're going to have Tyler Patman play the slot, and he was decent in limited playing time a year ago. I know he played well against Arizona when he was in midseason, but Tyler Patman's not Orlando Scandrick, and so the slot becomes an issue. Scandrick also had developed into their best perimeter corner, and now they're really counting on Morris Claiborne or Byron Jones, one of these injured former first rounders, to step up. We might even maybe see, if push comes to the worst kind of shove, maybe Corey White, the former Saint, gets to play opposite Brandon Carr. They're going to have a problem at the cornerback position, I think. And what's going to happen is, where before you had a defense that was schematically flexible, they could play man-to-man or zone, and they, everyone thinks Rod Marinelli, their coordinator, is a zone-based guy, and he is. But late in the season last year, they played a ton of man-to-man coverage, especially in the playoffs. You lose that dimension now because of Scandrick was your best man defender, and he gave you man-to-man element in the slot. So now I do think we're going to see a cover two type of defense. The saving grace for Dallas is, right when they become a more vanilla zone defense, they also acquire Greg Hardy and Randy Gregory. So if they can get the pass rush, then they maybe would have played that much zone anyway. So this isn't a death blow to this defense, but you're talking about losing your best secondary player, and anytime you do that, that's going to change or limit what you can do schematically.
Great, and that's a great point on adding, you know, Greg Hardy and Randy Gregory. I mean, if this happened to Dallas a year ago, I think that they would have been more adversely affected than they are now.
I agree with that. They maybe even wouldn't have made the playoffs a year ago without Scandrick.
Yeah. So the last guy we're going to talk about is late breaking news here for the MMQB podcast. We do, of course, record this on Wednesdays to try to get you the most up-to-date analysis here as we drop the podcast on Thursdays. And thanks again for listening. Junior Gallette, the former Saint, who caused a lot of trouble in that locker room and may or may not have tweeted a bunch of incendiary things about that staff and his teammates, ends up in Washington and looks like a great addition to the front seven there on a defense that looks to be a lot better than it was a year ago. Tears his Achilles today. How big is this for Washington? How big of a setback is it? And, you know, if you're Sean Payton, what are you thinking right now?
Well, if I'm Sean Payton, I'm thinking, boy, I wish Junior Gallette hadn't been such a jackass, because we could still use him. Even with a torn Achilles, he'd probably be our best pass rusher there in New Orleans. But if I'm Washington, it's not like they had anything built for Junior Gallette. They signed him late. He wasn't on the team a year ago. He was a bonus piece, and now they've lost a bonus piece. So Ryan Kerrigan, who they signed to a long-term deal, becomes the number one pass rusher again. And it doesn't matter, because they don't switch sides with these guys much. Kerrigan plays the left side. Gallette would have played the right side on passing downs. Preston Smith, the second-round rookie, more pressure on him. And I'm curious to see what happens with Trent Murphy this year and exactly what his role would be. The more I study him, the more I think about him. And also, I spent time with Ryan Kerrigan this offseason watching film, and we talked about Trent Murphy. The more I think that they've got a Jarrett Johnson-type player there, which means that he's versatile, but he's not a dynamic edge rusher. And that's not what Kerrigan said. That's my assessment. But so I circle that back to Gallette, because if that's the case, then you don't have speed off both edges. You have just Kerrigan as your dynamic piece, and then they're going to have to be schematically creative with the way they employ Murphy and probably Preston Smith as well.
You know, I didn't think we'd get a Jarrett Johnson reference on this podcast. Well done, sir.
Thank you. And it was my goal, 2 weeks ago, and I came up short. And, his retirement's really made it difficult to get his name in there still.
As an aside, I was fascinated this week by the reaction to comments from Glover Quinn when Jordy Nelson tore his ACL, and Glover Quinn says, God meant for Jordy to tear his ACL. And I was thinking that in terms of Junior Gallette, if you're the Saints, there are going to be some guys on that roster who think along the lines of Glover Quinn, like, well, he would have hurt himself if he was here in any case, because his time to get hurt had come. What do you think about that philosophy?
Well, that philosophy. Now we're literally debating one's interpretation of fate or spirituality or what. I mean, this, you know, this is the debate of all mankind. I mean, this is going to go nowhere. We could fill an entire year of podcast and say nothing about this.
I like it. I like talking about it. I like thinking about it because I think there's a sports psychology element to it, to where if you're Glover Quinn, you think that if I get hurt, I was meant to get hurt. It didn't matter if I had sat out of practice today, I was going to get hurt the next day. It didn't matter if I had taken this series off, I was going to get hurt on the next series. And so a lot of these guys think that way because it allows them to adapt and cope with being hurt. Instead of dwelling on how you might have avoided it, then you say, okay, well, that was meant to happen. What's next? How do I get back on the field?
Yeah, I mean, you could argue it's just a guy putting verbiage to a positive attitude, putting a positive spin on things. I think where people would take umbrage is when you're putting your positive spin or applying your, in this case, your beliefs or whatever on another player, a division rival team, and saying it was God's plan. You know, there's not a lot of upside for Glover Quinn to say it publicly.
Yeah, just being honest. I hate when people get killed for being honest. So we're going to move on here in the podcast. Quickly, I want to tell you guys about SeatGeek. From the NFL's Week 1 to Super Bowl 50 in Santa Clara, there's nothing like seeing the action up close. If you've never made it to a game in person, make this the year you finally treat yourself and do it with our new sponsor, SeatGeek. With their new app, it's easy to find a great deal, pay for tickets, and get to your seat with a few taps of your phone. And for listeners to this show specifically, if you use the promo code MMQB in the SeatGeek app, you get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. I suppose somebody could hear about it and not listen to the podcast and still get that discount, right?
Well, you'd have to use the promo code.
Right. Well, it takes less than a minute to download, and the app is free in the iPhone and Google Play stores. SeatGeek does a ton of things that other ticketing sites don't. Just like you can consolidate flight and hotel options online, SeatGeek pulls in ticket options from hundreds of online sellers. They also have a feature called Deal Score. It ranks every ticket on the market with a 1 to 100 value score and plots the best deals on a color-coded interactive map of the venue. Finally, SeatGeek's mobile app makes the ticket buying process seamless, easy, and reliable. To redeem your promo code and save $20 on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app today, enter the promo code MMQB, and SeatGeek will send you $20 once you've made your first purchase. Find the best deals on NFL preseason, regular season, and concert tickets too, all on SeatGeek. Don't forget to claim that $20. Now we're going to go around the NFL with a couple of decisions, signings made around the league. The first one I wanted to talk to you about was Reggie Wayne, the former Colts wide receiver, likely a Hall of Famer, if not a first ballot Hall of Famer, signs a 1-year deal with New England. He can reach up to $3 million in incentives. It makes sense to me if you were the Patriots. Right now on the roster, you have Julian Edelman, Brandon LaFell, Aaron Dobson, and now Reggie Wayne figuring to get the bulk of the playing time. What kind of impact do you think Wayne can make? And is this anything more than a 1-year stint in New England?
Well, first of all, I'm going to pull back the curtain on this podcast a little bit. About 45 minutes before recording, Klemko, you know, I can't remember if it was a text or an email, but you delivered some form of communication to me saying, let's not talk about Reggie Wayne. I don't think it's what, big enough news anymore? Is that how you put it?
I said it was old news. The signing happened a couple days ago, right?
Yeah, but I don't think this is old news at all. I think this is significant news. I think he's going to play a major role in New England. How can be a possible future Hall of Famer joining the defending champions in Tom Brady's team, how can that be old news ever? This is news until week one.
I'm completely in agreement, Andy. Now, let's get to the logistics of Reggie Wayne and the Patriots offense.
Yeah, I question the sincerity there. I think Reggie Wayne is an ideal fit for them. Now, the question is, can he maintain a high level of performance or a high enough level for an entire season? Because in Indianapolis last year, he was very good in the first half of the season, and then he faded down the stretch. I think New England has, I think they do enough with two tight end sets there that they can manage his snaps a little more than the Colts did. I would expect Wayne to play about 35, maybe 40 snaps a game. He is an excellent timing-based receiver. He's very good at the short and intermediate levels, and that is the crux of New England's offense. Wayne's also reads the defense well. He's going to do a good job on option routes. I think his style of play really matches what New England's style of play is.
I think the downside with Wayne is that, you know, he's going to start the season off strong, but I don't know if he has the legs to finish. And I think you saw that last year. His snaps were diminishing in Indianapolis, and I think part of that was the emergence of other wide receivers, but part of that is he's old. I mean, the guy has played how many years, how many seasons in the NFL? Forgive me for not knowing this right now.
He is in his 14th season.
14 seasons of not being a role player, but the go-to guy for two, you know, one absolutely incredible quarterback and one, you know, young emerging quarterback. I just watching him last year, and I actually attended in person maybe three Indianapolis games, but just as the season wore on, he became increasingly a non-factor. I think if the Patriots are smart and they want him to be effective, they will ease him into the rotation and try to get the best weeks out of him in the second half of the season.
And I think that's exactly what they'll do. And keep in mind, he's probably taking snaps from Danny Amendola, a guy who's been injury prone. So you could be solving two problems with one solution here by just having Wayne and Amendola share repetitions. Wayne will turn 37 in November. And you mentioned who he's played with. Can you believe when this is said and done, Wayne will likely have played with the three, maybe Aaron Rodgers is in the discussion, but I think he's going to have played with the three biggest headliner quarterbacks of this generation, with Manning, Brady, and Andrew Luck.
Well, it's reminiscent of the charmed career of Jerry Rice with Joe Montana and Steve Young. I think a lot.
And then Rich Gannon in his MVP years.
And too. Rich Gannon. Oh, wow. That's a critical mention there, because Rich Gannon is very underrated in terms of NFL history.
I agree with you. At least at that part of his career, he was. He doesn't get remembered for like that. You know, he's also very underrated as a broadcaster.
I think he's great.
I do too. There are certain weeks that I've got the ticket, and I'll go out of my way to watch whatever game Gannon's broadcasting, because I know I'm going to get better replay angles and better analysis.
Yeah. The other, I guess, news that I wanted to talk to you about, well, we've got two more items here going around the league. Brian Hoyer in Houston is named the starter over Ryan Mallett. Some would say way more upside to Ryan Mallett. We don't know when Arian Foster is going to be back at running back. That's a factor. My question to you is, what's the point of playing Brian Hoyer when you know that you're probably going to have a top 10 pick next year, despite, you know, how strong you'll be on defense?
Well, Klimko, they're not viewing it like that. The Texans aren't going in thinking, hey, we're going to get to 6-10, guys. Let's do this. That's not. They signed Brian Hoyer because they were a 9-7 team with Ryan Fitzpatrick and a slate of different guys last season. And they believe Hoyer gives them a bump more in stability. And come on, Klimko. Your question, you and these leading questions tonight. I think Hoyer is clearly the choice. And for one, you mentioned Ryan Mallett and his upside. Coaches tell you how they feel about their players by the way they utilize them. And Bill O'Brien had Mallett in New England, and he's had Mallett throughout his time here in Houston. Mallett's 27 years old. I mean, he's not a young guy. I mean, he's in the middle of his career. He's in his fifth season. The fact that he hasn't found a way into a starting lineup and here in Houston and has been beaten out by journeyman quarterbacks last 2 years, that tells you what Bill O'Brien thinks of Ryan Mallett. And Bill O'Brien understands the system and understands quarterback play. And so I hope that Texan fans can understand that and not spend the whole season lamenting the idea that they're not getting their young quarterback reps.
Well, I think the Texans fans will spend the whole season looking forward to 2016, when presumably they'll have Christian Hackenberg starting at quarterback.
That's such a negative attitude. Okay. Such a negative attitude. You know, Tom Savage is also on the roster. That also tells you how they feel about Mallett, that they took a guy in the fourth round a year ago. The young developmental piece on the roster isn't even Ryan Mallett. It's Tom Savage.
Yeah. Well, the next bit of news I wanted to get to, Evan Mathis, the left guard, surprisingly let go by the Eagles and Coach Chip Kelly after asking for more incentives in his contract, spends a couple months on the shelf, misses the start of NFL camp as a free agent, and finally signs a one-year $2.5 million deal with the Denver Broncos. Ed Werder reports he had a $5.5 million offer on the table. I'm a little bit skeptical of that, given that Mathis is 34 years old and Drew Rosenhaus has in the past been caught or at least disputed in claims of what a client could have accrued.
So you're saying that Mathis's agents maybe put out a hotter number than what was really out there?
I'd be interested to know what that team is that offered the 5.5. That's all I'll say.
I think Mathis fits what Denver wants to do. I mean, they're going to be a zone blocking team, and Mathis is a mobile player. He's been good in zone concepts before. The question to me, and Denver's slowly been answering these questions, but it's who do you have around him? And when this offseason began back in, you know, minicamp time, it looked like Denver's offensive line was going to be atrocious. But since then, Ty Sombrello, their second-round pick, has earned the left tackle job. They've signed Mathis, and they've got Luis Vasquez back at right guard. So the pieces are coming in place. Now it's a question of what happens at the center position, and can Ryan Harris at right tackle be mobile enough to give them a two-way go on their running game? Can they run right and can they run left? And even if you run left away from Harris, you still have to have someone who blocks the backside. So I guess the question now is at right tackle, but slowly but surely Denver's knocking or, you know, checking off the weaknesses along their offensive line.
Yeah. Do you think that Mathis is any kind of anything close to an upgrade over Orlando Franklin, who they lost in free agency to the Chargers? A guy who had a really strong second half of the year last year and gave up just one sack all season?
That's an interesting question because we're talking about different styles. I would caution about the sacks allowed thing because, you know, Peyton Manning is going to compensate for a lot of protection mistakes anyway. And it's also a matter of how you use your linemen. Or Franklin may have given up only one sack, but how often were they sliding the protection his way and giving him help? And we'd have to go through, and that's the kind of things that haven't been charted and don't get charted. But with Franklin, they were more of a man-blocking team. So he would be a pull blocker. They would have specific assignments. You know, you block him, you block him. And zone blocking, it's different. You all move in unison, and it's about spatial awareness and mobility. So I think for a zone scheme, Mathis is the guy you'd rather have over Franklin. I think if you're a man-blocking team, you'd much rather have Franklin over Mathis. So John Elway's getting it right here. He understood who to sign and not sign. Keep in mind, Franklin cost a lot more money, and their division rivals were the ones who paid it in San Diego. So they get a guy who fits their system better at a much friendlier price. Much friendlier.
Agreed on that end. Before we get into our next round of topics, we're going to take some questions here in the MMQB podcast mailbag. Some people actually responded to our hashtag in the last couple
days. Of course they did. We have good listeners. Yeah. We have excellent listeners.
You know what? I'm happy to report that I think 2 weeks ago we had our we eclipsed the 10,000 listener plateau. We're leapfrogging other SI podcasts.
Well, the goal is to just burn them all to the ground. That's the goal. That's the goal. And if you want to send us the question or a question that we can address on the air, just tweet at Robert Klemko or at Andy_Benoit and use the hashtag MMQB podcast. And real quick, let's tell you about FanDuel as well. It's the leader in the one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. They're going to pay out over $75 million a week this football season. This is the way to play fantasy football now. No more drafting mediocre teams that you just get stuck with in your office for the rest of the year. Each week is a new week, a brighter day, a chance to earn money, and it's an entry fee that started just $1, so there's a league for everyone. They've already got the week one NFL games set up in the FanDuel lobby, so you don't have to wait another day to start building your teams. And everyone else is doing it, guys. Over 1 million players have won money playing fantasy sports on FanDuel, and now it's your turn. So go to FanDuel.com, click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, use the code THEMMQB, the, you got to put the THEMMQB, and sign up now. And then also there's a bonus, $200 will be matched for the first 50 people each week that use the code THEMMQB. So hurry up and sign up and don't get left out.
And you know how we ended up being called the MMQB as opposed to just MMQB.com, right?
Yeah, some jackass bought the web domain years before us, didn't he?
Yeah, he had it was MMQB.com, and he had a furniture site, a really off-brand, weird kind of furniture site running. And they offered him some exorbitant amount of money. I actually know the amount, but I don't think I'm supposed to say
it. Yeah, no, I don't think we want to say it.
Yeah, but the guy didn't take it. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it was several living rooms worth of money that they offered this guy. Yeah, and he didn't take it. But don't visit his site. Just stick with the MMQB. Trust us, you don't want to go to it. It's full of pop-up ads. It's full of viruses and bugs, and you don't even walk in there.
The next segment that we're going to get into is a new one for us. We wanted to get to your mailbag questions. The first one, at the Mike Price, asks, which teams run the best read option and or packaged plays? And I think this is in reference to Chip Kelly's statement to the media and fans about the Suggs, Terrell Suggs' low hit on Sam Bradford. Not every handoff in shotgun is a read option. We heard the same thing from the Washington, the Shanahan father and son combo when Robert Griffin was making waves in that offense. I do not have a good answer to this question. I don't talk to as many coaches as you on the X's and O's. I would love to know what your thoughts.
Well, I think Chip Kelly is the guy that does the best job with package plays, and something that people don't realize about, you can argue, here's what we don't realize about Philly's system. You could argue it's just one giant package of plays. It's not a playbook. They've got about 7 or 8 different plays that they just run out of different formations and different tempo. And so it looks like a real high volume offense. It's by far the lowest volume offense in the NFL. So that whole system is packaged plays. Another team that does, I guess, I was going to say Atlanta, but really it's Dirk Cutter, the coordinator who's now in Tampa Bay, offensive play caller. He does a very good job with package plays, building one play off another, showing one look to set up another look later in games. So there's the answer to at the Mike Price's question. We got to talk about that Suggs hit a little bit, don't we, since it was alluded to? Did you have a problem with it?
No, I liked it. I think, you know, if you're presenting yourself as a runner and you're not reeling backwards as a quarterback, then you need to get put down. Terrell Suggs, probably a little bit overzealous. However, I think that the league in general has done too much to protect quarterbacks. I'm not a big fan of all of the penalties that come from just, you know, getting a whiff of these guys. So I was happy with what Suggs did.
I thought it was a perfectly legal play. It was exactly what Suggs did to Colin Kaepernick down the stretch in the Super Bowl a few years ago. Look at it this way, guys. If you leave a defensive end unblocked, how can you reasonably ask him to not go hit the quarterback? Is an unblocked defender really supposed to not touch a quarterback at all? If he's unblocked, no, whether it's a read option call or not, and 99.5% of the time, if there is an unblocked defensive lineman, it is a read option call. If he's unblocked, to Suggs, it is a read option. And he had the quarterback in that scenario. He was responsible for the quarterback. He's unblocked. He took the most direct path to his responsibility, and he hit him. That is football. I mean, did he hit him a little low? You know, we can maybe get into the nuances of that. But the idea that Suggs is supposed to not do anything because Bradford was clearly handing the ball off, not to Suggs he wasn't. Suggs lined up, the snap took place, and nobody blocked him. You can't assume the quarterback's clearly handing the ball off when you're unblocked.
Yeah. To get to our second listener question, Cal Norso asks, what are your thoughts on what Michael Bennett said? Now, Michael Bennett has said a number of things in the last couple days in separate interviews with ESPN Radio and a magazine profile for Chicago Magazine. I'm not exactly sure what Cal is referring to, so I'm just going to pick my favorite Michael Bennett quote of the week.
Yeah, because there were a lot of them in this most recent interview, from what I understand. There's always a lot of these Bennett brothers, you know, it's always a grain of salt anyway with them.
Right. So the one that I liked and the one that I particularly agree with, he tells ESPN 710 in Atlanta, quarterback is the only position in the NFL where you could be mediocre and get paid. At every other position, you can't be mediocre. If I was Ryan Tannehill and the most games I ever won was 7, how do you get a $100 million contract for that? I guess that's just the value of the position. Now, for a little bit of context, Bennett signed a four-year, $28.5 million extension last offseason. Your thoughts on his comments on the quarterback position?
No, he's spot on. Yeah, that's exactly right. And we've talked about that and why we don't analyze quarterback contracts too closely, because they're just a function of the market, and the market is skewed with quarterbacks. Our researcher, John Daigle, passed along another quote, and I didn't know Bennett signed this. I guess, yeah, he signed that extension this last offseason, so I have a little bit of a problem with him saying this one I'm about to read. And also, I don't quite even understand what the hell he's talking about, to be honest with you. But he says, I'm not saying I don't like it here, presumably here being Seattle. I'm like a wife who can't leave a husband she doesn't love anymore because she loves the kids. What does that mean? I get what he's saying. I get the point, but I don't get the analogy side of it.
Having not even heard that entire interview and not knowing the context, I'm not going to go there.
Well, he's not talking about his actual wife. He's talking about the Seahawks.
I know, but this feels like one of those quotes that gets pulled out and then everybody's, you know, dissects it. And I need to hear the whole interview.
Okay. All right. Well, then let's move on to AP Best Ever, who asks us, who are your Super Bowl picks? And I can tell you mine, and yours is the same as mine. We'll tell you next week, AP. And Robert, you talked to our colleague Emily Kaplan earlier today. So before we get to your little mini controversy or whatever we're calling it with the Chris Carter thing, which I'm eager to hear you talk about, and I know other people are as well, you did an interview with her. Can you kind of tee that up and then we'll play that?
Yeah, Emily had a great story this week on Browns fans and why they just keep coming back. And her and I had a funny backstory to that. So here's Emily Kaplan and myself. Joining us as a special guest on the MMQB podcast is my friend and colleague, Emily Kaplan. Emily, how are you?
This is a great honor, Robert. I'm doing great.
Yeah, it took us a few weeks to get you on the podcast. We kind of debated the merits of it, but then we figured we'd give you a shot.
That's totally understandable.
You had an interesting story this week, one that I was privy to as we were both in Cleveland, and Peter said, Emily, I want you to do a story. I can't even do a good Peter
impression. Yeah, that was pretty bad.
He wanted you to do a story on Cleveland Browns fans and why they still show up. Because we were seeing fans show up in record numbers to see Johnny Manziel and that team in Berea. And you and I went to a random bar in East Cleveland, this impoverished area. And take it away. What was the scene?
Yeah, well, the first thing, it was not so random. I had been on that street before when LeBron James announced he was going back to Cleveland. I got sent on assignment for Sports Illustrated, and that was among the streets that I frequented. So I dragged you, I'd like to say, in your rental car. You were in a fabulous mood. I think both of our phones had like 4% battery on them. It was a wonderful day. And we show up at this bar. There's probably 4 bars open on that street, maybe 4 establishments open. We walked in the back door.
Well, first we tried to go in the front door, but that was locked.
This is true. And we went to the back door, and the first thing that you noticed was a stripper pole.
And so I just kind of hung back. And then the first guy we talked to is wearing, he was wearing some sort of Browns t-shirt, and you know, we're happy about that. And he just happens to be belligerently drunk at 2 o'clock on a weekday.
Yeah, so I start taking down some notes, and I'm asking him about why he's a fan. And about 90 seconds in, my Penn State journalism ethics education kind of kicked in and said, you know, this guy's not getting quoted. But we stuck around, and there was a lovely bartender, and she was wonderful. She was telling us a great story of how her mom almost kicked her out of the house because she brought home her neighbor's keychain, which had a Ravens keychain on it.
And what was the money quote? You ended up talking to another guy, and he said something that I think was either in our headline or our subheadline.
Yeah, this is Reggie Davis, was a lovely man. And we said, you know, why, after all these years of failure, you know, do fans keep coming back? And Reggie so eloquently says, it's like Santa Claus. If you keep believing year after year and you keep wishing, eventually you're going to get what you want.
I think right about now, Andy Benoit, listening to this as we wait to go back to the podcast, is probably rolling his eyes because he just doesn't love all this flowery feature writing stuff that has nothing to do with X's and O's.
Yeah, he's not the type of kid I would imagine that would believe in Santa Claus.
No. Andy definitely figured that out when he was like 3 years old. No Santa.
He probably spoiled it for the rest of the state of Idaho, probably.
I wanted to ask you about another story that you did, a really, really great profile on the new 49ers coach, Jim Tomsula. Obviously, they've had one of the most miserable off seasons that you can have as a pro football franchise. The only thing that they have left, really, is the quarterback and Navarro Bowman, the linebacker, and he's coming off an ACL surgery. You lose a head coach who had taken you to NFC Championship games, a Super Bowl, and he's replaced by the defensive line coach, Jim Tomsula, and you spent some time with him. Were there any moments that you observed or anything that he said that kind of got left on the cutting room floor? I've been meaning to ask you about that.
One of the things, actually, it was just something that I learned while I was there talking to him and his family that got left on the cutting room floor, is something that happened in San Francisco. And this is kind of a story that I think just speaks to why he's the perfect man for that job. And it's because they're looking to change the culture. And the morning of the press conference that everyone knew that Jim Tomsula totally fumbled, and it literally looked like a Saturday Night Live skit. That morning, Jed York and Trent Baalke asked all of the 49ers employees to report to the cafeteria because they personally wanted to introduce Jim Tomsula as the coach. And everyone comes in, you know, Joan from payroll, the cafeteria staff, the janitors, the pro personnel guys, scouts, and they're lining the cafeteria. And the minute Jim Tomsula walks in, they give him a standing ovation. And there was women crying, as it was relayed to me. And I think with that, it sounded like this absurd scene, you know, out of a movie. But what it shows is that Jim was kind of that employee who was always overlooked, you know, everyone loved in the building. He's that guy that just does his great job, but always gets overlooked for his raise because he's always too nice. And finally, he was getting his due. And everyone really kind of recognized that. And that, I think that just kind of shows of what they're looking to build there.
Yeah. How does that not make the story?
You know what? We have some really tough editors. They don't love the sappy anecdotes like that. I only get one of them a year. I guess I used it on Santa Claus.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. The last thing I wanted to ask you about was another head coach. You, being a Penn Stater, are familiar with this guy for his very short but successful run in state college. Bill O'Brien, Texans head coach, now being featured on Hard Knocks, the show that nobody in the NFL wants to do, and they have to beg a team to do it every year. But inevitably, you know, head coaches become more popular with fans after appearing on the show. Assistant coaches get their names out there. Guys who are cut and end up on other rosters become minor celebrities based on, you know, what they say and how they behave on the show. What, if you've been watching, what have been your impressions of O'Brien? Is there anything that jumped out to you or reminded you of some interactions back in school?
Yeah, well, thank you for revealing my age. I was at Penn State when Bill O'Brien was there. But I have watched it, and I think it's exactly as I imagined him to be. Kind of, I think that he was probably kicking and screaming and saying his favorite F word a million times when he found out he had to be on the show. He hates that type of attention. I think one of the reasons he left Penn State is, you know, as a college football coach, part of your job is being a politician and kind of, you know, rallying the community around you. And he doesn't really like that. He kind of just wants to focus in coach speak on the X's and O's. But, you know, you saw in last week's episode, and sorry, this is a spoiler for anyone, and when this most recent episode, the piece about his son, and, you know, he's a family man at heart. He has kind of a tragic story and his son being really sick, but he doesn't want anyone to have sympathy for him. But, you know, when he's around his players and when he's in that building, he's a totally different guy. And, you know, for the Penn State players that I knew, a couple of them are in the league now, like Allen Robinson with the Jaguars and John Urschel. And you guys are all going to meet Christian Hackenberg, the stud quarterback next year. That's what they loved about him, because he was so different from Joe Paterno. He literally, you could not find a more opposite personality of kind of what they brought in.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us on the MMQB podcast. Say hi to Andy.
It was my pleasure. Andy, hello. I'm sorry to waste 8 minutes waxing poetic about sappiness, but back to your X's and O's.
Later, Emily. Always enjoy hanging out with Emily on the road. She was my MVP of the MMQB training camp tour.
Do you want to explain your Chris Carter thing now?
Sure. Well, as we close the podcast here, I wanted to get into something that's a little bit more personal than the X's and O's stuff that we are constantly talking about on this podcast. That's why we're saving it for last. So if you don't care, you know, get out of here.
And maybe for the people who don't know what we're talking about, the Chris Carter thing, you want to explain that? You want me to tell them?
Sure. I got it. So Chris Carter was at the rookie symposium that I had access to in 2014. I went to the NFC rookie symposium. Recently, Chris Borland, who attended that symposium, was interviewed by the Fainter Iwatas with ESPN. Incredible story, beautiful story. And he was talking about kind of the bizarre things and you know, missteps of the NFL. And he talked about how a former player got up at the symposium and said, have a fall guy. So if you're going to do crimes, if you're going to get in trouble, have a guy that knows he's going to get arrested for that. So I wrote this in-depth story about the symposium, and people started asking me on Twitter, what's the deal? Why didn't you write about what Chris Carter said? So rather than say nothing, I wanted to be completely transparent. I wrote what was a very long tweet on TwitLonger. I'll just read some of it here. So 2 days ago, I wrote, "A year ago, I attended the NFL symposium as the first writer to gain near unfettered access to the rookie orientation. I agreed to the NFL's condition that I would not enter the small group sessions, and there would be one or two things the league could look back on and say that was off the record. When the public relations or marketing arm representing an organization or a player facilitates access such as this, there is often a verbal agreement that certain details observed in the course of reporting may be negotiated for omission. I only agree to these omissions when the subject matter is immaterial to what I gather is the larger point of the story, which in the case of the symposium, I believed Carter's comment was. Having interviewed numerous people involved with previous symposiums on and off the record, so as to give NFL employees the opportunity to honestly critique the new setup, I was satisfied that Troy Vincent's vision of involving ex-players was proving fruitful, even considering the risk of someone like Carter saying something stupid to the rookies. The sources of actual constructive advice, I judged, far outweighed Carter's comments. When Carter said the words, have a fall guy, in what was a lighthearted and animated session that at times made league employees in attendance cringe, the NFL's Kim Fields looked my way and said, that can't go in the story. I was torn. I take pride in reporting every detail, even at the risk of damaging relationships. Earlier in my career, I profiled a player who had a string of unreported violence in his life. Knowing these were not details the player or the agent wanted public, I published them anyway because I judged those facts material to the arc of that player's journey. The agent hasn't spoken with me since." So I go on to kind of explain my thought process, but there were a couple misconceptions in what was written about what I said that I wanted to address here. The first one being that I, you know, traded my integrity or responsibility to report, you know, the whole truth in order, in exchange for some kind of great access. I don't have a good relationship with the NFL, first of all. You can go back and look through my stories. At various times, the Ravens and Washington's football team have made me persona non grata. I couldn't even talk to any of their guys, couldn't get any phone interviews over the phone. I had to show up, and even when I showed up, it was a disaster. And that was because of stories that I'd written and things that I'd tweeted reporting facts about the team. The NFL absolutely hated my story from the Super Bowl on the ticket secondary market and how these guys come in and buy up tickets and rip off fans during Super Bowl week and make large, you know, amounts of money. At the MMQB, we don't shy away from writing about concussions. I mean, one of my biggest stories a couple of years ago was on Russell Allen, who had a stroke on the football field. You know, they weren't big fans of me in the league office for that one. A couple of years ago, I wrote about Thursday Night Football and had players talking about how dangerous it was and how much it was a wear on their bodies. So if you look back at my stories, none of them are driven by this access that the NFL is supposed to, you know, pour onto the MMQB because, you know, we don't report on the negatives of the NFL. So the reason that I ended up not publishing the Carter comments is because they were an anomaly to me. I, you know, armed with the knowledge that I have now and realizing what big news it was that he said that to the rookies, taken out of the context of the whole symposium, I would have taken a harder look at it and I would have, you know, tried to negotiate and talk to the NFL a little bit about why I think it's important to go in the story. But then at that moment, when I'm hearing all of these incredible things about how much the symposium has changed from players, from people involved on and off the record, it just didn't stand out to me, the Carter comment. I think a lot of players took it as a lighthearted, fun session, not necessarily an informative one, but they got a chance to meet a couple of Hall of Famers. The other problem that I have with the backlash is this notion among readers and all the people who have tweeted at me that no other journalist makes retroactive off-the-record concessions. I would challenge you to find any feature writer who's been in an interview with somebody and hasn't had somebody say, oh man, I shouldn't have said that. Can that be off the record? And 90% of the time, people grant you that request. Yeah. I mean,
it's the right thing to do. Yeah. That's the right thing to do because we guys speak out loud and we're not the people would also criticize if you got in the business of gotcha journalism.
Right. So there's don't get me wrong. There's a fine line to walk and I would have to think long and hard about, you know, what I would do if faced with this situation again. As a result of all of this, I don't think I'll have this opportunity because I did, right. I did, you know, spill everything that happened down to who told me I couldn't write what at the.
Hey, maybe you'll get invited to the AFC symposium.
I'll just have to bulk up and sneak in as a player next year. But the unfortunate thing about all this to me is that now it seems like I'm some stooge of the NFL when I don't even have a relationship with the people in the league office. I mean, I haven't had an access-driven NFL story since this one, just because I'm not interested in that sort of thing. But, you know, I understand the backlash. I understand the expectation that people have that I should have reported that. They weren't there. I was there. And at the time, I didn't feel that it was important enough to go back on an agreement that I made with the NFL.
Look, Robert, you were, and I guess I'm coming to my colleague's defense, but I'm coming to anyone's defense here. You said that you got to attend the NFL symposium, which most people, I mean, that's a very private environment. So it's not common at all for a journalist to be inside the symposium with the kind of access you got. And because of that, it was under the condition that a few things could retroactively be off the record. That's what you said up front was that the league reserved the right to basically tell you, hey, you know, can you please leave that out? And that's end of story to me. I mean, this is just one of those things. So, yeah, I mean, no one's getting on Chris Borland for he didn't name the speaker. No one's in. He doesn't have the same responsibility as a journalist, but he did make the thing public as well. So I don't think it's a big deal.
I think people imagine that shows like Hard Knocks or inside stories where like a writer is in a war room with an NFL team, they're just, you know, there's no restrictions and you just get to write what you see, or Hard Knocks just gets to publish what they see. When in reality, there are conditions when you go into sorts of things for this level of access. The only way that, I was the first writer in that room at the symposium. So the only way that I was getting in there was to you know, make a couple of concessions to then.
You were the first writer ever, right?
Right. I was the first writer ever to get a whiff of the symposium. And if I had come out of that experience and said, wow, they've got a lot of idiots talking to these NFL players and giving bad advice, then I think it would be my responsibility to relay some of that bad advice. But I just didn't feel that way coming out of the symposium. And now it's come out and it's come back to bite me and I got to take my lumps. But, I'm not going to apologize for what I did.
Well, and the lumps come with that's comes with the turf, my friend. And you know that. You've learned that over the years. That's all we got for you on this week's The MMQB Podcast. For my buddy Robert Klimko, I'm Andy Benoit. Tweet us with the hashtag MMQB Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Later, guys.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.